You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica toku ingoa no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Olivia. E whai akine coming up on the show, I speak to lecturer in the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago, Dr. Johanna Reddy, about school uniform equity in Aotearoa. Olivia, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Otago, Warren Tate, about the links between ME/CFS and long COVID. I also speak to Dr. Remy Musson about the prevalence of parasites such as toxoplasmosis and cryptosporidium.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anu hi pakihiri, roki roki maurunga i te pai tuku tuku. O irirangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
ME/CFS and long COVID are both chronic diseases that can cause fatigue and memory loss. Researchers have referred to patients as the missing millions due to their inability to sustain employment from the illness and are often neglected by health services. I spoke to Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Otago, Warren Tate, about his research in this area. His study has shown that ME/CFS and long COVID are closely related, meaning that further research and treatments can be for the benefit of both groups. What is ME/CFS?
Okay, so give you a little bit of background. ME/CFS stands for myalgic encephalomyelitis, that's a long name, / chronic fatigue syndrome, a little bit more easier to understand. And these two names came from as a result of outbreaks in two parts of the world. The ME name came from an outbreak at the Royal Free Hospital in London in 1955, and the chronic fatigue syndrome, the CFS part, arose as a result of a viral outbreak in Incline Village, Nevada in 1984. And it really wasn't until about 2016-2017 that those two names came together to represent post-viral illnesses. So it's really an umbrella name for all of what we now know are post-stressor illnesses that come about after the person's immune system is highly stressed by some event, mainly viral, in their lives. By contrast, long COVID, of course, is the result of a specific virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And so you could regard it as a specific example of ME/CFS, and that's what I always think of it as. But the uniqueness about that is we've never had such a pandemic of so many viral infections. 800 million was mostly these other, there's been about 100 boutique outbreaks of what we now give rise to ME/CFS over the last 100 years. And they've been a few thousand cases And so they throw up at most a few hundred cases of the post-viral syndrome. But of course, with long COVID, with COVID and long COVID, we've had 800 million cases of the infection, the viral infection, and that's given rise, it's thought, to about worldwide about 100 million cases of long COVID. So huge numbers of people worldwide with this severely debilitating, ongoing post-viral fatigue syndrome have resulted.
What does your research say about the links between ME, CFS and long COVID? Like, what are the physiological commonalities between them?
So what of interest to me particularly was that I've studied ME, CFS intensely for the last 10 years, having come from an ME, CFS family. My daughter first got the illness over 35 years ago. And what's happened with ME, CFS research is that there's been very little investment. In other words, never hit the headlines like long COVID has. And so researchers have struggled through around the world to try and understand the pathophysiology. And so in my own research, we've contributed a lot to that in the last 10 years. However, now with long COVID, there's a huge amount of investment going in the rich countries like the United States to understanding long COVID. And so what was important to know was that was long COVID really very closely related to the umbrella illnesses under the term ME-CFS, because it meant that what we'd learned about ME-CFS could be translated to long COVID patients, but equally important, what's going to be found, hopefully, with all of this money that's invested in the research on long COVID could actually be applied back to ME-CFS patients who've had their illness for 10, 20, 30, sometimes 40 years. So the aim of our research then was to understand better the pathophysiology of long COVID. In other words, what's the dysfunctional physiology in that illness, and then link it and ask whether, in fact, it's very similar to what we find with ME-CFS. And that's exactly what the researchers found. We found, we looked at immune cells because the first response to these viral illnesses is effect from the immune system, which doesn't resolve in the people that go on to get the illnesses. So we looked at the immune cells of both groups of patients, and we found there were two main defects. One was in the proteins involved in the immune system itself, and for long COVID, for example, we found 37 proteins were dysregulated. And the other main system was in the production line for energy production. And there we found 21 proteins along that production line were dysregulated in long COVID. And with ME-CFS, they were the same two systems, but we found more examples of dysregulated proteins. And we think the reason for that was because our New Zealand patients with long COVID had had their illness for 1 year. All of the cohort we looked at, whereas with the ME-CFS people, their average length of illness had been 16 years. So we think that those people with ME-CFS that have had their illness longer, there's been a kind of a consolidation of the dysregulation, and so there are more individual molecules that are dysregulated in those illness. But basically, the two conditions are very similarly are very similar to each other, and that the good news of that is that anything we know from ME-CFS can, I think, be applied to long COVID, and anything we find out now about long COVID, you know, can be applied to help ME-CFS patients. And the aim of this, of course, is that it's a devastating illness, and as we've known from ME-CFS, for most patients, it's lifelong. And so anything we find that can basically improve the quality of life for these patients is going to be hugely beneficial.
What is an example of treatment that can be used both for ME-CFS and long COVID?
Okay, so if we take the two aspects of physiology that were dysregulated in both conditions, one was in energy production and the other was the immune system itself. So currently we have quite a lot of compounds out there, nutraceuticals, some prescribed drugs, that are potential molecules that can affect what's called oxidative stress. And oxidative stress is an indication that the energy production system is not working very well. But none of these have been tested in clinical trials or systematically. But what happens with patients now, of course, when they're, you know, they're desperate, anything they hear about that might help them, they try. And so the applications of therapies is very chaotic. What our research has shown is what we need to be doing is looking at these individual compounds that can affect oxidative stress at different parts of the energy production pathway. If they should be looked at individually and in combinations in clinical trials with lots of patients to see whether they can actually provide definite benefits, maybe to all the patients from the groups or even subgroups of the patients. So it's more directed, more organised therapies that have the potential to have benefit. In terms of the immune system, we're in a revolutionary phase of immunology at the moment where immunotherapy developed is amazing for all sorts of diseases. So there is the potential to develop immune modulators to correct some of the immune defects that we're seeing in these conditions. And so that will take quite a lot of effort and money, but at least that's the direction that is being pointed to provide therapeutic benefits for the difficult patients, and that would be a little bit more in the future than, say, those that we could try now with the energy production pathway.
Are there any actions you want the government or other entities to take to assist in this area?
Worldwide, people with ME/CFS have been called the missing millions, and that is because there's been no national programs to recognise and that this is a serious illness. The people are severely debilitated and they need national programs of support from their social systems, financial systems and whatever. New Zealand has certainly been no different from that. With all of the sort of exposure now to long COVID, of course, we have an opportunity to provide national programs so that all clinicians get best practice, evidence-based management for patients that they will see with their condition. So any patient in New Zealand with now ME/CFS or long COVID, the aim would be that wherever they are living in New Zealand, whichever clinician they see, that clinician will know what the best practice is. We don't have that. We haven't even had registers of people, you know, with ME/CFS, and there's an attempt now to get a register for long COVID. So that's one thing. The other thing, we've had no formal teaching in our medical schools of these illnesses. I give one lecture a year at Otago, which I've done since 2013, just to expose the students to ME/CFS. It's been last year long COVID as well. And so we need all of our graduating doctors to be confident with their knowledge and understanding of these illnesses. So when they have patients come to see them, they're not, you know, they're very difficult illnesses both for patient and clinical practitioners to deal with. So they need to be best prepared and so they can show this understanding and knowledge and have management practice for their patients. So, you know, that's what I hope will happen immediately. So for example, we had a clinic set up in Christchurch with a number of practitioners with different skills that were dealing with a few of the long COVID patients in the Christchurch area. By all accounts, it was extremely successful, but it was shut down after 6 months, as I understand, just because of lack of resources. So those are the sorts of clinics which need to be established. So, you know, any CFS and long COVID patients can have the same respect and dignity as patients with other major diseases in our community, like cancer and diabetes and Alzheimer's disease, for example. So that's my great hope.
That was Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Otago, Warren Tate, speaking to me about the links between ME/CFS and long COVID.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
We'll be right back, but we're just going to take a short break. Keep it on the B.
Sorry, Mittens, our plan has failed.
Rats! Why couldn't she just forget me? All I want is to be a street cat.
We'll need a new plan.
I've got it. All we need is a realistic life-size cutout of me.
First, we'll need the perfect photo. I'll head to ProGear. Oh, yes, perfect. More paw. Lovely. You're a natural.
ProGear Photographic. For photos so crisp, you'll think they aren't photos. Head to ProGear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Pull it together with the Science of Tension these summer holidays at MOTAT. January 3rd till the 26th. Twist, stretch and tuck with activities including slacklining, tug of war, tetherball, a spring-free trampoline, a bungee run course, plus so much more. MOTAT's summer holiday experience, January 3rd till the 26th, from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Find out more at motat.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
The Tico Beats with Juliana Sion, Amanda Bovo and guests with support from DJ Bobby Brazuka.
And tomorrow,
a live tribute to Tribe Called Quest, followed by DJs Luca and Martina Mack.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Mass Appeal is here to resurrect your Sunday mornings with jazz, funk, hip-hop, house, and other slick selections from the sacred vault of High Priest Pudge. Mass Appeal, every Sunday morning from 10 to midday on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Ahead of the new school year, concerns have been raised about the high cost of compulsory school uniforms amid the rising cost of living. New research has found that 20% of students in one school in a higher socioeconomic area were worried about whether their parents could afford their uniform. I spoke to lecturer in the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago, Dr. Johanna Reedy, about what can be done to ensure students experience the benefits of school uniforms without added pressure on families. Here is that interview. Can you tell our listeners about the impact the cost of school uniforms is having, particularly on families?
It gets to the point where families can't afford to kit their children out in full and correct uniform. The reasons for that are numerous, but when you've got a cost of living crisis, there's only so much money to go around. The calls on that money are much stronger. And so you're having families making choices between eating in school uniform or going to school at all because they can't get their children out in the full and correct uniform.
So you mentioned that some students aren't going to school at all because they don't have the correct uniform. Can you speak to the implications to students?
The first point is whether the schools know why their students aren't coming to school and whether the uniform is a question there. Now, for high equity index schools, they will understand how costs affect most of their students, and generally schools in the formerly low decile rankings, they're usually quite well set up to respond to their needs of their students. But even so, it still relies on students being able to say that their parents can't afford uniforms, or families being able to raise their hands and easily say, but we just can't meet this cost. And so what happens is at the beginning of the year, you'll have students who don't come to school or don't come to school regularly because they don't have a full and correct uniform. You might have a situation where a school is a bit lenient and trying to get everyone in on the first day, and then maybe the clamps come down on full and correct uniform. And unless there's a really good relationship with students or a way that families can explain in a way that doesn't attract too much shame, I guess, that uniform is a cost problem, you'll have students not attending or not paying attention or not being able to settle because they look different to other students, they are not in full and correct uniform, and they're just not ready to learn. And that's a great shame.
How widespread is this problem? Are students at schools that have a higher number on the equity index or those lower decile schools being most affected by this?
In New Zealand, we don't really have very good data for that. But in the pilot survey or the pilot study that I'm undertaking with my colleagues, we looked at three different schools and they've got places, different places on the equity index. Even in the highest school, when we looked at the survey, about almost 20% of students said they worried about the cost of uniforms and it being a strain on their families. So even in schools where you've got a more affluent population, almost 20% of students are thinking about the cost of uniform. This is at secondary school. So it's a persistent issue, and it seems to be something that worries students. And as far as we can tell, there's not any proactive approach in this country to do anything about it, despite the fact it keeps coming up year on year.
And why are school uniforms so expensive?
That's got a number of factors. The first and probably most powerful factor is that schools are the ones who prescribe the uniform, school boards. So the cost of the uniform is directly associated with the types of garments a school board decides are core compulsory parts of a new school uniform. So that's the biggest determinant. And it's also a big determinant that's in the control of schools. The second determinant is obviously how much competition there is in the uniform market and whether schools are following the Commerce Commission guidelines on school uniforms and supplies and are regularly reviewing their supplier arrangements and checking that they're getting a good deal for the uniform that they deem compulsory. And then, of course, there's the cost of raw materials. And New Zealand's at the end of the world and, I guess, at the end of the supply chain, and we're at the mercy of what goes on beyond our shores. And some of it is just increased costs of raw materials that manufacturers and retailers can't absorb and have to pass on to the consumer.
What benefits have staff indicated uniforms have, and are there any alternative ways that students could get these benefits without the high cost?
I mean, the alternative is not having a uniform, but again, that has a number of problems as well. I mean, uniforms were originally instituted because you had secondary, well, minimum schooling rather becoming compulsory, and students not turning up because they felt they looked so different from their peers, that their appearance wasn't acceptable. And so we have school uniforms to provide an affordable suite of clothing that removes the worst of competitive dressing, you know, that pressure to have labelled clothing. I mean, obviously it won't do away with it entirely. There'll still be some accessories that are labelled, but the main clothing set takes away that difference. And then security, being safe on campus and being able to identify intruders onto the school grounds. So yes, there are benefits for the school. There's also benefits to be shown students are able to settle faster to task and they have fewer distractions. They report they have fewer distractions in class. So it helps them settle better and maybe makes it a slightly less pressurised place to go to. It doesn't have any impact on academic outcomes though. You can have a fancy uniform or a plainer uniform and neither of those clothing sets will affect academic outcomes. So it's a very, very tricky situation in this country. I think when you're thinking about the benefits of any uniform, or I guess any type of clothing, you really need to be thinking about, you know, is it ethical that we're requiring students to wear these clothes when we know that affordability is a real issue for the very people who could benefit from wearing those clothes and also benefit from coming to school and having an education. And it's almost like we've reached a bit of an impasse. Like year-on-year principals will say it's a good investment, it does the job, there are so many benefits to it, which I think nobody's arguing with in this country. But parents are saying it's too much. The upfront cost is a lot. The cost of maintaining it is a lot. Something needs to happen. And so you've got organisations like charities who step in and help people out with grants to schools or grants to individuals. But they're running at capacity at the moment. And then you've got WINS, or the New Zealand government, that has criteria for loans for particular school items. But that's something that has to be paid back. So you're kind of robbing from Peter to pay Paul there, because you're taking money out of one area of a family's budget, putting it in another for a short while. But that doesn't overcome the problem that there's just not enough money in some households to cover these costs. And schools don't have funding for this. They're taking money to fund school uniforms for their students out of, I guess, the operational grants or particular grants that they might get directly from charities. And so you've got the example of, like, the Rotorua school, intermediate school, who've taken the decision to fund school uniforms so everybody turns up ready to learn. Well, that's a marvellous idea, but it kind of begs the question, what else could that money be spent on for those students? And I can absolutely understand why the school has taken that decision, but it would make more sense, wouldn't it, for the government to say, this is a known issue, let's try and do a bit of research and figure out the magnitude of the issue nationwide and fund this so schools could not be worried about what their students are wearing, have the benefit of a uniform and focus on children's learning and those factors that we know do make a difference to children's learning, which is teacher quality, relationship between the teacher and the student, how well nourished students are, etc., etc. I think we've got to the point where it might be time for government to be a bit more proactive in the school uniform space. I think at the moment the New Zealand school uniform policy from a government perspective is very reactive. If there is a problem, the government will react to it. There will be a complaint to the Commerce Commission or the Human Rights Commission. It's getting to the point where perhaps it's time for the Ministry of Education or for the government first to come up with some legislation like they have in the UK, saying that schools must give attention to the cost of uniform, but also uniform policies that would allow them to have a baseline of information about the state of school uniform in New Zealand and how it affects the government's investment in education, whether local policies are helping or hindering the government's investment. And that might give some better indications of what we as a country can do. So every year in January, we're wringing our hands about this problem, but nothing really happens to solve it.
And that was lecturer in the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago, Dr. Johanna Reedy, on calls for the government to intervene on school uniform costs.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We'll be back. Keep it on the B.
Motet this anniversary weekend for Ngamiru Miru Bubbles.
Soak up 3 days of science shows, bubble displays, arts and crafts, plus so much more. Be blown away with bubble fun for the whole whānau.
Ngamiru Miru Bubbles, 27th till the 29th of January. 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Find out more at motet.nz.
To see a world in a grain of coffee and a heaven in a perfect roast. Hold infinity in the mug in your hand and eternity in every gulp.
Atomic Coffee. Each bean is a world of its own, and when they are blended together expertly by the Atomic team, they create a divinely good coffee.
Atomic Coffee, available at The Roastery in Kingsland and 3 bustling espresso bars in central Auckland.
Or get your fix online at atomiccoffee.co.nz.
Out for 2024? Charcuterie boards, stand-up paddleboarding and frappes. In for 2024? Mac and cheese in the mosh, eels and jorts.
Don't forget outfield.
Fields are out?
No, in.
Fields are in?
No, outfield festival is in.
Got it! What about fields?
If you want to get to Outfield Festival, then listen to Drive all week for your chance to win tickets.
Outfield Music, Food and Arts Festival 2024, Saturday, February 10th at Te Awanga Downs.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morning, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago. The 95 BFM Kids Show with Lee, 7 to 9 every Sunday morning on BFM.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Little is known about many parasites, despite their prevalence worldwide in Aotearoa New Zealand as well. These parasites include Cryptosporidium and Toxoplasmosis, which are both often transmitted from animals to humans. Research has shown both parasites are dangerous to humans, with symptoms including vomiting and fevers. I spoke to research fellow at the University of Otago, Dr. Remy Musson, about these parasites and the need for research funding in this area. What are Cryptosporidium and Toxoplasmosis, and how are they transmitted?
So, well, that's a loaded question, Lydia. So they are, Toxoplasma and Cryptosporidium parasites are both protozoan parasites. For humans, these are the most important ones. And although Toxoplasma and Cryptosporidium are both largely transmitted by contaminated food and water, the diseases they cause are entirely different from one another. For crypto is obviously my favorite one because I've been working with it for the past 5 years with Professor Bruce Russell at the University of Otago.
Why are they dangerous? What are the effects of these parasites?
Well, they're quite unique. So toxoplasma infections could make a person unaware of any symptoms while their immune system is fighting the parasite. Sometimes you can get flu symptoms with painful muscle aches. However, it's far more serious if someone infected is a pregnant person, and because it can increase the risk of miscarriage and stillbirth. As for Cryptosporidium, you get the classic symptoms of intestinal infections, you know, like nausea, diarrhea, fever, etc. But we are very fortunate in New Zealand that no one died from the recent outbreak. Okay, before we go into the symptoms, people need to be aware, Olivia, that globally, if a child under the age of 5 is infected with crypto, there is a really good chance, let's say 30 to 50%, that this child will die or have long-term health complications. But I haven't even gone into the, I haven't gone into the things that we still don't know about them, but we can cover that later.
On this issue, what are the treatments for these parasites?
Well, for Cryptosporidium, we don't have really effective treatments for Cryptosporidium. We have natazoxanide, which works really well, but it doesn't work really well on most children or people with a compromised immune system. Let's say if you are someone who is an AIDS patient, so the treatments would not work for that at all. Well, there are some treatments for toxoplasmosis, for the toxoplasma, but again, we still don't know a lot about these parasites.
In your opinion, what steps should the government take around precautions and safety regarding these parasites?
If we talk about Cryptosporidium, for example, so even before the incident in Queenstown, Cryptosporidium infections have always been among the top annual notifiable diseases, sometimes even top three. I think we should address the elephant in the room using two facts. So one, cattle, so all cows are the number one hosts or sources for Cryptosporidium parasites. And two, we have a tremendous livestock industry. So New Zealand's biggest exports are dairy products. And there's at least 6 million dairy cows in New Zealand, not counting the other livestock and livestock farms destined for meat. If we combine these two facts, we can arguably say that crypto is the most dangerous. Other countries have shown a severe economic impact due to Cryptosporidium, and the impact can range from healthcare to production yields. So the government's initiative to install the protozoan barriers in water supplies will help a lot, but we will still have no effective treatments or vaccines against Cryptosporidium or Toxoplasma. And just like the other parasites, we don't really understand how their life cycle works. So I think what the government needs also to do is we need more parasitologists. We need more research funding. So our lab has established a robust drug screening platform for Cryptosporidium, one of the very few in the world. But we struggled quite a bit to get where we are due to lack of funding, and which was obviously worsened by the COVID-19 epidemic.
Are there any individual actions people can do to reduce their risks of transmittal or things that people should be aware of?
Yeah, okay. So we'll always watch what you put in your mouth, obviously, even if it's just a pen while daydreaming. So I do that a lot. Watch your pets too, especially if you're a cat person. Are you a cat person, Olivia?
I actually am, yes.
Okay, so you need to hear this. The cats are the only animals we know that can complete the life cycle of Toxoplasma. So they allow the release of infective Toxoplasma parasites. These will be shed by your cat in its stool, which you may accidentally ingest or even inhale. If it gets dry, you can even inhale it. With crypto, it gets worse. So if you are infected, that can spread like wildfire. So make sure you are well isolated. Sure, if you're a healthy adult, you'll likely get your typical tummy symptoms, fever, nausea, etc. But if you are a child or immune system is compromised, then the parasite will surely exploit your body even further, which can lead to death or long-term complications.
Can you be tested for it? And can your animals also be tested for it?
Yeah, of course. You can. See, the thing is about Toxoplasma, if you test your cat, that you can do some antibody testing, but it won't show you if the cat had it or had it. Does that make sense?
You mean if they've had it previously?
So if the cat already had Toxoplasma, it will produce the antibodies. So I think the levels of antibodies is also important, but it's quite difficult to determine if the cat has it or not. Most of the symptoms are asymptomatic. Most of the infected hosts are asymptomatic, so they don't show any symptoms.
What don't we know about these parasites?
There's a lot we actually don't know a lot. That's why they are classified as neglected diseases. But here's another fun fact. I think at least it's estimated that a third of the world is actually infected with Toxoplasma. Within a conversation like such as this one, so you, me, and the guy next door, one of us has Toxoplasma, likely, without any symptoms. But intriguingly, so this is the problem. Toxoplasma parasites can invade brain tissues. And this is where it gets a bit dark, because there is now more and more evidence directly linking Toxoplasma to serious mental health disorders, ranging from depression to anxiety to even increased aggression. And we have no clue how many in the population are affected or how many of mental health patients in the country are directly linked to Toxoplasma infections, given the very high rate. As for Cryptosporidium parasites, well, they can live up to 6 months on any surface you can think of, whether it's wet or dry. And the secret to this longevity of this parasite is the shell they're encased in, known as the oocyst, and they can survive everything, including chlorine and alcohol-based disinfectants. That's why in swimming pools that just doesn't work. I mean, in short, we're surrounded by Cryptosporidium parasites, especially in rural areas. And yes, no one dies from this here, but there is also growing evidence in developing countries with infected young children displaying slower growth and cognitive development. So in Bangladesh, for example, 75% of poor children are infected with Cryptosporidium parasites. That's horrible. And more than half of them display stunted growth. So we don't know how much of this affects New Zealand's children on a long-term basis, especially with the highest population that always gets Cryptosporidium in New Zealand are children under the age of 5.
Are there any other countries that in New Zealand we wish to follow the research models of or treatments that they've been using that we also want to have here?
So there is no treatment for Cryptosporidium. So if you want to treat Cryptosporidium, you have to treat it at the source. And the source of it is usually cattle. Cattle, livestock, so all these animals, like even sheep, but we should do cattle. There is one drug for cattle, but it's actually a bit expensive, and it's harder to use because you have to consult vets to get it. But like I said before, Cryptosporidium spreads like wildfire. So we desperately need something that is easy and something that you can give to all the herd without any complication. There is no effective treatment against Cryptosporidium anywhere.
That's a depressing note to end on, but
it's a bit frustrating because people really need to consider a career in parasitology. There's not many parasitologists. They're extremely difficult to understand, these parasites, and that one of the main reasons for that is because we share a common ancestor with them more than, let's say, bacteria. So their targets, their cellular machinery is somewhat similar to ours. So it's really tough to find specific targets against them. And yeah, so, and Cryptosporidium, there's a fun fact, can spread to many, many hosts. So that includes dogs, cats, even fish, birds, anything you can think of, Cryptosporidium can be found there.
That was research fellow at the University of Otago, Dr. Remy Musson, speaking to me about parasitic threats in New Zealand.
That was The Wire.
Ko ere te hōtaka katoa. Mō tēnei wiki ni te mihi ki a koutou I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in and thanks to our producer Olivia. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.